Good evening, everyone. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and this is Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Welcome to Southwest Florida, a very stormy night here. I hope everybody is dry and safe and secure where you are. One of my all-time favorite authors is with me tonight. John Gilstrap has written a series called The Scorpion. His Jonathan Grave character is one of my favorites of all time. This past year, he also wrote five saga novellas. They run one after the other, called Nick of Time. We're going to talk about that also. He is an amazing author, and we've spoken before, so I'm glad he's here. John, welcome back to Authors on the Air. How are you this fine evening?
I am very well, thank you, and it's dry and lovely here. I'm in Virginia.
Oh, how nice. Well, you know, Southwest Florida, we have that little tropical storm passing by, and our governor, who, you know, our governor, decided to claim 34 of our 56 counties a disaster or state of emergency or something. So, and because it's the beginning of hurricane season, every news station picks it up, and it's like, oh, my God, the apocalypse is here. You know, we're kind of used to that now. It's a lot of rain. This is the rainy season here in Florida. It's hurricane season. We're used to it.
Well, here's hoping everybody gets through it well.
I think it's going to be fine. It probably won't develop anymore into beyond a tropical storm, so it's all good. Well, welcome back, and it's nice to talk to you again. The last time we chatted was at VoucherCon. You and Revis Wortham did an interview that did not go well because we were kind of pushed back into a room next to a cafeteria, I think, and it was horrible. So I'm hoping
cafeteria,
I'm making up for it now.
Cafeteria, construction site, it was pretty loud background. I do know that.
Hotel law, and they gave us, just said, here, you can have a private room, and yet the whole thing was open at the top, so we heard every sound in the entire hotel, didn't we?
Yes, indeed.
It was crazy. So congratulations on, first of all, Nick of Time, your ebook novella series. There are five novellas in this. It's a very, very compelling story. Would you please tell me what made you decide to write Nick of Time? And then we're going to talk about what exactly they are, the Nick of Time books.
Well, yeah, Nick of Time is... it's sort of a coming-of-age story, I guess, although that makes it sound very cliched. Coming-of-age with an edge of a killer. I like the idea of a modern-day Bonnie and Clyde, but with one party being innocent. I mean, what happens in the Nick of Time series is we have Nikki Jansen, who is a terminally ill teenager. What she needs to have is a bilateral heart-lung transplant. And, you know, 17 years old, she's rebellious. She's lost her mom to cancer a couple of years before the story starts. And she does not want to spend her last 6, 8, 12, 15 months, whatever it is she's got left, hooked up to stuff in the hospital. And via the internet, she finds her old heartthrob, Brad, who is a foster child who lived with next door to her years before, and they start this chat online, and he says, well, come away with me, you know, let's have an adventure, let's spend your last years or your last months having a good time. And that just sounds wonderful to her, and she runs away. What she doesn't know is that Brad has escaped from prison, and he's a murderer. And so there you go. We set up for this wonderful thriller that also has a very dark side. That story kind of raced into my head, and it was a lot of fun to write.
Well, it was a lot of fun to read, I have to tell you. It was kind of like you forgot the age except when her father stepped into the page. And he was a very interesting character, too. You mentioned that Nikki's mom had passed away, and so Dad was doing what he thought was the best, but is kind of, I think, in a lot of cases, forgets to hear what the kid is saying. And It was a very, very, very interesting character that you created there. It kind of was a road trip, a last road trip, set of yes. books, and I really enjoyed them. So the first book in the Nick of Time series, which, by the way, was just a great, great name. I loved it completely. So the first book is, and there are five books, by the way, for those of you listening. The first one is called Time to Run. And that is when she meets her buddy, handsome, dangerous Alex Ward is facing a different kind of death sentence. Sent to prison for felony murder, he has escaped and rekindled his connection to Nikki. Now, have you since renamed him, Brad?
Yes, he was Alex.
Yeah.
He was Alex in the early drafts, and then he became Brad right before he came out. I'm just hoping that the name doesn't change somewhere within the actual published novel. It's probably the last global change that we made was to change his name.
Right. So I think this is great. I like the way that they hooked up. She had very fond memories of this boy, and he's really quite dapper for a kid of his age. He's seems kind of worldly, and he tells her, "Don't worry about things. Don't worry about things." And for a 17-year-old girl, it sounds perfect. It's just what she wanted to hear. He gets that she doesn't want to spend her remaining days hooked up to machines or anything else. But there happens to be just a little twist when it comes to her medical. So then you bring us Time to Hide. So we are back, by the way, in your page, it is back to Brad Ward. So we've got that. Let's talk about Time to Hide, because something happens to change her father's desperation to reach her.
Well, her father's a prosecutor, and he learns he has more knowledge about Brad than Nikki has. Nikki is living a dream, and her father is living the reality that he's got a terminally ill daughter who needs to be in the hospital. And she wants to do anything else but. And as the story evolves over the course of the five books, one of the things we learn, for good or ill, you know, I love creating characters where the readers can argue among themselves, was he really a good guy, was he really a bad guy? But Brad has nothing to lose. You know, we learn as we go on that he ain't going back to prison. He's not going to do that again. And so at one level, we could argue that he's using Nikki. On the other level, Nikki really needs him. He's providing her with the life that she's always wanted to have. It's very sweet, except none of it is real. You know, Brad provides her with this wonderful evening, sort of a princess evening with the gowns and it's just sort of a James Bond tuxedo kind of thing, but none of it is real and all of it has consequences. And and that's, everybody has a journey in this book. Nikki certainly has a journey about the reality of grown-up life. Her father has a journey of understanding who his daughter really is, kind of for the first time. And Brad is a man of conscience. It's all evidence to the contrary notwithstanding, Brad is a man of conscience.
He really is. I liked his character very much. I had empathy for his character very, very much. But I also remember what it was like to be a rebellious 17-year-old, as far back as that actually is. And I cannot imagine being in Nikki's situation and not rebelling. It just made sense to me. It made sense to me, especially with one parent gone and the remaining parent seemingly really not interested in listening to what she had to say. I thought that was very, very, very interesting. The next book is Time to Die. And unfortunately, along the way, Nikki and Brad are blamed for a crime that they didn't commit. And that just may be, I think, the big turning point in this story. What do you think? Have I got it
certainly.
Wrong?
No. It's what makes it's what makes the reality of their fantasy life hit them hard, because now they are tied to a very real crime with very real consequences that happened in the today. You know, right now, you can't write it off as, well, something I did in the past, something that was, you know, in my youth. And they are entirely innocent, but because of the baggage they carry, they are presumed to be otherwise.
It's definitely the turning point in this story. The tension has ratcheted up so high that I have to tell you, I was really ticked off that I had to wait in NetGalley to get the last book. So I wrote to your publicist and I said, okay, just give me the widget now. I'm not waiting. You know? And so she sent me the last one, Time to Live, which is a stunning outcome that you never, ever, you assume, you think you know what's going to happen. And boy, by the time that book is over, there have been four or five different things going on that changed the game completely. It was magnificent. Magnificent.
Thank you.
Congratulations. What
Thank
a
you.
Fun
I was,
group
I was hoping
of
that people would be absolutely confident of what was going to happen. And then I think it's the last, you know, I don't know the printed pages, but certainly the manuscript pages, the last 10 pages reset everything.
Oh, boy, they sure did.
And I
no
love
doubt.
To do that to readers.
Well, you certainly did to this one, and I'm used to your writing. You know, I've read all your books, so I am used to your writing. I'm used to anticipating, you know, a couple red herrings in there, but never in my wildest dreams. When I read this, I had no idea at all. None. It never even dawned on me. It was not a scenario that I would have envisioned. So, you know, from someone who considers them themselves kind of a John Gilstrap expert because of all the books I've read, this one totally threw me off. It was really great. A lot of fun. So,
lo and behold,
and I really hope that you pick up the series of books, listeners, because, boy, are they ever good. And, you know, if you don't have time to read a full book, this is really bites of suspense that you can read. You can sit down in the small allotted time you have and read each book and then have a very satisfying story and a very, very, very satisfied ending. So check them out. So then I'm looking again and I'm thinking, oh, I wonder when those books are coming out. And lo and behold, my friend NetGalley and I see Friendly Fire, which has not been released yet. But before we talk about that, I want to go back and talk about the book before. I don't know if it was Against All Enemies. Yes, I think
Against
it was
All
Against
Enemies.
All Enemies. That's the one I got from you at BoucherCon.
Right.
I really like Jonathan Graves. I like him totally because you don't only write him and boxers from the standpoint of the operatives that they are and what their mission is to bring home, you know, precious cargo and to bring in the priest into it and to bring in, I love their assistant. She's so great. But all of those characters, Venice, right. I love all of your characters, but each and every time after a mission is completed, you delve a little bit deeper into the Scorpion's persona and the way the mission has affected him personally. The toll it takes on him. I find that fascinating because a lot of times a series character, when I read series like that, there is no repercussion of the mission that just passed. Tell me, are we going to learn more and more about Jonathan Graves? Are we still kind of peeling away the layers of him?
Oh, sure. I mean, at every book, there's a at the mechanical level of writing a series. I mean, Jonathan, the structure of these books is that Jonathan always goes on a mission that is nominally involved with rescuing somebody from the clutches of bad guys.
Right.
Normally, it's much more complicated than that, but that's kind of the basic fabric. And
sure.
The victims, the people who are being rescued or helped, are the ones whose story arcs have to play out over the course of a single book. Jonathan, I'm structuring him to be a very, very, very long arc. And the idea is I know this guy. You know, it's really funny. I mean, Jonathan Grave is one of these that, you know, I know so much of his backstory that readers obviously can't know about yet, but they will over time. For example, why is he no longer in the Army? You know, we know
right.
through some of the books that there's been conflicts with the upper echelons, but, you know, it really never delved into exactly what it was that got him separated. But the bottom line is this. I think that he really is on the side of the angels. A lot of people die in the books, but most of them need killing. You know, I mean, they're bad guys,
sure.
and they're doing bad things, and they are, if they were to put their weapons down and just surrender, Jonathan wouldn't kill him, but they don't do that. And in Against All Enemies, he comes up against a group of amateurs who are playing to be professionals, or planning a coup against the government. And they are so inept, yet they're armed, and they end up dying because they don't surrender, and because in all of this takes an emotional toll on Jonathan. And yeah, I think it's really important for the readers to understand that for warriors or people who deal with violence on a regular basis, it really does take a toll. In my own case, you know, I have never been in war, but I was a firefighter and emergency medical technician
right.
for 15 years, and dealt with a lot of violence and a lot of bad things. And the way you deal with it in the immediate time is with that shell, you know, the armor, that impenetrable,
absolutely.
Nothing gets to me, and you sort of laugh it off, and it's the dark humor and all of that. But it really does have a cumulative effect on you. In my case, you know, you can't hold a dead child, or you can't watch somebody pass on and not have that take something from you. You don't show it because, you know, you're the guy, you're not part of the emergency, you're the one that's supposed to be there. And in Jonathan's case, he is causing a lot of havoc for all the right reasons, and he needs to find a way to vent that, and fortunately he has Father Dom, his best friend, who also is a priest and a psychologist.
I think that's a great outlet, but that, you know, is, but you're right. Look, listen, I'm a certified victims advocate. I worked for police departments for a long time, and, you know, specialized with sexual assault and domestic violence, and saw a lot of horrible things.
So,
and it does. You, there are techniques that we use to inoculate ourselves from the immediate shock and the horror and the anguish of everything that's happening. But you're right, it is very cumulative. And I don't know that it doesn't profoundly change you if that is the career you choose for a real long time, unless you have some really great coping skills and someone like Father Dom, obviously, to help you get through it. So this was a very devastating book for Jonathan Grave, I believe. But now we move on, and I know this is not out yet, but I want to talk about Friendly Fire, because this is such a fascinating book, the way it starts off, and really pulls everything that Jonathan is and why his life is so secret and all together, along with, like you say, you've layered it with other stories. There's other things happening too. Jonathan is not in a funk in this book. He is a little up, and I think that he thinks that His things are going pretty well for him. And then mm-hmm. his past comes back, correct?
Yes.
So it's the story starts with a young man who was an abuse survivor. He was an abuse and torture survivor. And the actual person who did this, perpetrated this crime, was never caught. And this young boy thinks he sees the guy when he's working as a barista in a coffee shop, and runs out into a road and after the guy, and before you know it, the perpetrator is dead. Oh, all well and good. Great. You know, the guy deserved it. But this young boy can't substantiate his story because, of course, everything with Jonathan Grave is never done in the open. It is a fascinating prospect.
Yeah, Jonathan was his rescuer, and people died in the rescue, and a guy got away. And so here we have, and this all happened 11 years before, 11 years ago. So the kid is now 23 years old. He was 11 years old when he was kidnapped and then ultimately rescued by Jonathan. And so for 11 years, this has been a great victory. You know, it's been a feather in the cap. Look, we reunited a kid with his family, and Jonathan moves on. And now you have a young man, you know, 23 years old, he's been charged with murder. I mean, for everybody else, and he does this within in front of dozens of people. He runs out of a coffee shop and stabs a guy to death. And you know, we're giving away chapter one here, so I mean, it's not a big deal.
Right.
And when Jonathan finds out that the kid's only defense is self-defense, but there is no record because Jonathan is the one who did the rescue. But what's even more is that the people Jonathan did kill, the bad guys he whacked when he was going in to make the rescue, that lives on in that community as an unsolved homicide. So the idea behind this was not just to get, you know, that actions have consequences in the case of in Jonathan's world, but he has to risk exposing himself as a murderer, right? Because that's what these homicides are considered in the local community, in order to save a young man's life. And how is he going to do that? And of course, you know, there's a lot else in there. What he finds out is that the kidnapper that Ethan, the boy, kills, was in fact about to do really bad things. And then Jonathan gets ahead of that too. It was a fun book to write. Yeah, a very emotional book to write, to be honest with you.
Well, it was a great book to read. It was just a lot of fun to read too. I don't know how you continue to do stories like this, and each and every one of them is a brand new story, and there's new insights every single time, John. So, you know, kudos to you for keeping it fresh and real. I want to talk about some of your other characters, because Jonathan, while he's obviously your protagonist, is not the only character that is important to every single thing he does. Let's talk about boxers and where he came from.
Okay.
And you'll because I can't even say his name. I just know that it's, you know, boxers.
Brian Vandemulebrocky.
There you go. And describe boxers for those who've never read a Jonathan book.
Well,
the description.
The way he's been described is 6 foot huge and would likely bend the needle on a scale.
There
so
you go.
So that's it. I
and
mean,
it's
he's
solid
somewhere...
muscle. He's not fat. He's just all solid muscle.
Yes. He's a big guy with this rumbly voice. And it's interesting, and he's white. And I say that only because I have heard from so many readers who read the character and they assume, with his Dutch name, right, Vandemulebrocky,
right,
they assume that he's African American, and he's not. He's this really big guy, probably Jonathan's best friend. He is most people's absolute worst enemy. Boxers lives to do violence, but he has a big conscience too. And he's that guy you definitely don't want to be on the other side. And he's not Jonathan's sidekick. In some regards, he's Jonathan's truth test. You know, it's, you know, hey boss, are we really going to do this? Boxers gets more love letters than Jonathan does. In terms of email, the stuff that I get, that he's got
really?
Three marriage proposals. Yeah.
Interesting to me. Do you think you'd ever do a book where Boxers was featured before Jonathan?
No. I don't. Boxers succeeds as a character because we never see his point of view. He is always observed by others.
Yes, that's true.
I think it's in Threat Warning. There's a line where it's an ancillary character. They're about to go and steal an airplane, and this mechanic looks around, and behind Jonathan, he sees Boxers coming out of the woods. The guy says, "Holy shit, you brought Sasquatch!" You know, it's that. Boxers is that guy, and he's an amalgam of several people that I've known. It's inappropriate to name them, but you know, through the fire service, you know, these huge, lethal, kind, scary, wonderful folks that do unspeakably heroic things and enjoy every single minute of it.
Well, Boxers really, really is all about doing the PC, correct?
Right. PC is Precious Cargo. Right.
So he's all about that. He wants to just get in there, get out, and get that victim out of there and get them into safety. And sometimes it's just never that – well, most times it's not that simple. And there's always blowback to everything. You also have a really great character named Venice, spelled Venice but pronounced Venice. I remember when you first introduced her a long time ago. Would you tell listeners a little bit about her character and how she came to be?
Well, Venice, and this is funny. I'm not sure what I've written and what I haven't written in this case, but Venice's story, when Jonathan Grave grew up as Jonathan Gravenow, whose father was a criminal. And a very successful criminal. They grew up in the lap of luxury in Fisherman's Cove, Virginia, which does not actually exist, but it's on the northern neck along the Potomac River. Excuse me. And so when Jonathan was growing up, his mother died very young, and Mama Alexander, whose real name is Florence, was the lead housekeeper. And Venice Alexander, her daughter, was sort of the gangly teenager who really liked, she just kind of had a crush on Jonathan growing up. And as she, Venice, got older, she changed her name from Venice to Venice because she thought it was more glamorous and it kind of stuck. But she has a way with electrons. I mean, she's just a computer genius. And Jonathan went into the army, came back, got married. That didn't work out very well, and Venice got into some trouble with the law, and Jonathan used his influence or his father's influence to get her out, and now she is the former daughter of the housekeeper, is now his right-hand go-to tickler of electrons. And Mama Alexander, the housekeeper, Jonathan's father, is now in prison in a supermax for life and probably to be featured in a novella next year. But his father's in prison, and Jonathan inherited all of this, and he sold the mansion to St. Kate's Catholic Church for a dollar and turned it into Resurrection House, which is designated home for the children of incarcerated parents, with the condition that Mama Alexander and Venice have a home perpetually, and that Mama would become essentially the not the headmistress, but the head mama for all of the kids.
Head mama
in
for all
the
kids.
Yeah, she's the hug giver.
Do you think that Jonathan, I don't know, do you think he he's glad that he did that and that he wants to support it even more, and that he has his conscience feels bad about what he has to do?
I think Jonathan is as self-actualized as he can be. He's not interested. He couldn't possibly give away all his money. But he tries. Nobody outside of the readers who read the book and Father Dom and selected others have any idea that he is the philanthropist behind so much of what he does. He just wants to make the world right. He is a product of crime. He spent his career doing good, doing well by doing good. He joined the Army and became a member of the unit Delta Force and left the Army, and now he does this freelance hostage rescue. And he also runs a private investigation firm that's very legitimate and very successful on the side. So I think Jonathan says he's on the side of the angels, and I think he really believes that. What he can't stand is an abuse of power, and he can't stand the thought of someone separating another person from their family to make money or to leverage for ill-gotten purposes.
He's an honorable man. I agree with you on that.
He's
a very, very honorable man. Where did the name Scorpion come from?
Honestly, this should be so much a better answer than it actually is. It was a throwaway line in No Mercy, the first book, where he says, "Call me Scorpion." It sounds cool, and that's really where it comes from.
I remember when I read that, and I thought, I didn't know that that was can't recall that being the first time he said it. But I have to tell you, that was the first John Gilstrap book that I read simply because my zodiac sign is Scorpio, and I thought, oh, I got to read this. And then I had to go back and read backwards and then forward. So, too many books ago for me to recall exactly. I remember reading that, but I thought it had been, that was his name anyway, that was his covert name or something, maybe when he was in the Army.
Maybe it was. I don't know. I haven't gotten to that. Probably it was. But I needed to call him something. I'd written myself into a corner, and I thought, well, Scorpion's kind of cool. So that's where it came from.
It really is.
I realized it's really got some juice with it, right? So, okay. So
it does. It actually does. It actually does. What's on the list for you? I know you're writing still. I know this book has not come out. It won't be out. Friendly Fire won't be out till when?
June 28th. It's close.
June. Oh, we're close. Okay, so we're a couple weeks early. Good. I hope everybody goes to get this book. It's magnificent. Really, it will hold you on the edge of your seat. I'm a very fast reader, and I'm familiar with how John writes, and so I can go through books pretty fast. But it is worth it to get this book and take your time and read it through. It gives you really a good look at who Jonathan Grave is and who Boxers are and all the rest of the characters. It's a really very, very interesting, very well-written book. What's on the agenda for you, John? You're welcome.
Well, before we get to what's on the agenda, I want to say that that book, Friendly Fire, this sounds like hype, but it's really not. I think it's the best thing I've ever written. It's the book, as an author, you get in the moment and there's a certain mechanics to it, but you're always emotionally invested in mm-hmm. what you're writing. But I had the story of Ethan Falk, who is the precious cargo, the kid that kills the bad guy in the opening chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Telling his story and getting into his point of view was one of the most emotional rides I've had as a writer. And in reading the book after it, you spend a lot of time writing it, and then you proof it and all that, and then finally you sit down and read it, and I'm just so pleased with the way it turned out. I don't often have that kind of an emotional reaction to a story that I know so well and that I've written, but that's what happened with.
Well, I will
fire.
Tell you that having worked with victims, sometimes, you know, for just on the spot, the crime scene, or later on to help them find resources and everything, it's a very true feeling story. It feels right for someone who had been victimized at an early age. It felt right when he talks about being in jail and the things that happened to him.
And the fact
felt
that his
right
parents were essentially embarrassed by
yes
and imperiled.
It's a classic response.
Yeah.
It's a classic response. I don't know if you read today's headline about the rapist from Stanford University.
I saw that there was a headline. I'm not sure what the story is.
Yeah. Okay. So a young man was charged and convicted of three different felony counts involving sexual assault. The judge, because he had been a scholarship athlete, a swimming athlete, and had planned to try out for the Olympics, the judge said he didn't want to hurt this poor boy's chances in life. And then you read the victim impact statement of the woman who was sexually assaulted. She was unconscious, and he assaulted her behind a dumpster. And the story, it's like reading fiction, except I know it's true. And then the boy's father said, I don't understand why he has to register as a sexual offender, you know, in that sexual offender thing, for 20 minutes worth of action.
Oh, my God, really?
Oh,
oh
God,
man.
You know, what a horrible, horrible, horrible. And I don't even understand. I wonder what that boy's mother thought. But here it is. I've seen it over and over and over again, working with sexual assault, domestic violence victims whose family members want. Listen, I was, you know, a victim of a attempted murder by my estranged husband. And I remember telling, you know, talking to my mom, saying I did my first national interview in USA Today. And she said, why did you do that? And I said, because Janet Reno had just been appointed as the U.S. Attorney General, and I was one of the first cases to go through her domestic violence court in Miami. And I said that, you know, they asked me someone to speak out. I have a big mouth. I have no problem speaking out about it. I showed my crime scene photos, you know, and I continue to do so, as you know. And she said, but do you think anybody we knew will read it? And I said, Lord, I hope so. Well, after, you know, my mom and dad were from New England. That was not something that you talked about, you know. I mean, it just wasn't. They were horrified. And after a while, I would take my mom to some of my lectures, and she would say, oh, this is my daughter. She's the advocate. And she's won all these awards and everything. So, you know, yes, it's very difficult for parents to talk about all of these things. But also in this boy's case, you have to remember that they hired Jonathan, and it was not because they, you know, they wanted any noise about it. So I think that, you know, you made a really good point there.
So it was a fun. And I should also mention that Nick of Time, the novellas, the five novellas are an ebook creation. In September, those will be assembled into a single paperback that will come out in I think September 27th or something. So it'll be
okay.
Available
will those be in the book room at VoucherCon?
They should. Yeah, VoucherCon, sure. I hope.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So I want an autographed copy once again when I see you.
Oh, you bet.
Yeah. So. What's up on your agenda now, John? What's happening with you? You're writing already. I know you mentioned that. You said that deadlines are your best friend. That's when you're most creative. So
it's where deadlines best friend meets worst enemy.
There you go. There you go. Are you writing another Jonathan book?
I am. I'm probably a quarter to a third of the way through Final Target, which is the July of next year, 2017 book. And it looks like the movie version of 6 Minutes to Freedom, which is the nonfiction book I wrote that essentially provided all the research that fueled the Jonathan series, that film took a giant step forward. It looks like it's actually going to be made. So,
congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. More
oh,
to follow.
Wonderful.
That we can't make an official announcement on casting yet or anything else, but there's a script out there. I haven't seen it, but the rumor is that it's good, and a check has been written, which is the important part from the author's point of view.
Absolutely.
So we'll see. Fingers crossed.
I want to ask you, since you mentioned character and casting and everything, have you ever, I mean, I think Jonathan Grave would be a great movie or series, actually a series. Have you ever envisioned a character, an actor for him?
Well, first of all, your lips to God's ear on the series. You know what?
Right.
I have never described Jonathan. I have never described
I know you
boxers.
Haven't.
And,
I know you haven't.
And there's a reason for that, and that's because readers have different views of what these characters
yes, they
look
do.
Like. Younger readers
yes,
see him as an impossibly young character. He couldn't possibly have the life experience that he has and be the
right,
age they
right.
see him. You know, older folks see him more as a Bruce Willis type, who's I don't know how old Bruce Willis is, but I'm going to guess he's knocking on the door of too old for the character.
Yeah.
So, but the basic answer is no. I really don't. I see.
Do you?
When I write
do
Jonathan's
you
point
have
of view,
a vision
I mean
of him?
I
but
have,
do you have a vision of what he looks like, of his physical description?
Beyond being kind of a tall-ish, muscular guy, no. No.
Fascinating. And what about for boxers?
Well, I do, because there's a his physicality is based on a guy that I knew back in the day. I mean, he was, honest
okay.
to God, to walk into a room, he had to duck. A standard doorway was too short for him. And
oh
he was, this guy was gentle until he wasn't. And
wow.
great fellow, a lot of fun, and then he would get scary. So that's kind of where boxers comes from, in terms
interesting.
Of his physical size. And this guy could
well,
press a car if he tried to, you know. It's just a big
I know, and I think
dude.
I think boxers could for sure. You know, he just, I mean, I can just imagine him like grabbing onto the tail of a helicopter and keeping it grounded. That's just my vision of him, you know. I mean, somebody I'd really want on my side.
You certainly don't want him on the other side.
No, you sure don't. You sure don't. I'm so happy for your success. Congratulations on, I hope the film comes through. Let's hope and pray that we see it. Even though I don't own a television, I'd go and find it. You know, I'd go watch it with somebody. Jonathan Grave becomes a reality. Boy, that would be wonderful, because these are terrific books, John.
Thank
they
you.
Really are. A lot of reading pleasure comes from your books, and thank you very much for that from someone who just loves to read. I look forward to seeing you in September. And
I will certainly be there in New Orleans. What could possibly go wrong?
Right? And it's my first visit out there, so I'm really excited. I am planning on taking some extra time and actually doing it upright. God knows, you know, someone's going to have to, like, put a leash on me or something so I don't get lost. But I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm looking forward to seeing you and all the usual suspects out there. I guess this is going to be the biggest BoucherCon they've had in a while.
I would think.
Being
in New
Orleans.
Yeah. And New Orleans is back. I have a love-hate relationship with New Orleans. It's a town built around debauchery, so what's wrong with that?
Right.
You know, after Katrina, it was kind of a sad place. Last time I was there, it was really, really good. And what we're going to have to do, we'll find an opportunity to go out, and we're going to get you some grilled oysters, which is a
okay.
New Orleans thing that's just outstanding.
Okay. Well, we'll do that. We'll grab our little crowd there, and we'll go and do that. I'm going to be broadcasting from there, of course. And I'm looking forward to it so much. And then the following year, interestingly enough, it's on my turf in St. Petersburg. And so that's going to be a lot of fun, too. I'm looking forward to that. And it's the perfect time to be down here, too. The weather is nicer, and hopefully no hurricanes, but it'll be fun. thank you so much for spending so much time with me tonight. I really enjoy it. I wish you and the missus happy travels.
Thank you.
I enjoy seeing your photos when you guys are running around. And give our friend Rev a big hello for me. I know you'll see him too. And
indeed.
And we'll talk again soon, okay?
Okay. Tomorrow night,
everybody, I'm speaking to Jacqueline Nichard. Jackie is just a delight. Those of you who don't remember her, she was the first author who had her book chosen for Oprah Winfrey's book club when it first started. Her new book is called Two If I See. Jackie and I saw each other a couple months ago. I can't wait for you to hear her. John Gilstrap with Jonathan Graves. Thank you so much. Have a great evening, my friend, and talk to you again soon.
All right. Take care. It's been a lot of fun.
You too. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's it, folks. Have a great evening, and thank you for being with us, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Go read a John Gilstrap book.